The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O sinless Arjuna, I have already explained that there are two classes of men who try to realize the self. Some are inclined to understand it by empirical philosophical speculation, and others by devotional service. Purport. In the second chapter, verse 39, the Lord explained two kinds of procedures, namely Sankhya Yoga and Karma Yoga, or Buddha Yoga. In this verse, the Lord explains the same more clearly. Sankhya Yoga, or the analytical study of the nature of spirit and matter, is the subject matter for persons who are inclined to speculate and understand things by experimental knowledge and philosophy. The other class of men work in Krishna consciousness, as it is explained in the 61st verse of the second chapter. The Lord has explained also in the 39th verse that by working by the principles of Buddhi Yoga, or Krishna consciousness, one can be relieved from the bonds of action. And furthermore, there is no flaw in the process. The same principle is more clearly explained in the 61st verse, that this Buddhi Yoga is to depend entirely on the Supreme, or more specifically, on Krishna. And in this way, all the senses can be brought under control very easily. Therefore, both the yogas are interdependent as religion and philosophy. Religion without philosophy is sentiment, or sometimes fanaticism, while philosophy without religion is mental speculation. The ultimate goal is Krishna, because the philosophers who are also sincerely searching after the absolute truth come in the end to Krishna consciousness. This is also stated in the Bhagavad Gita. The whole process is to understand the real position of the self in relation to the super-self. The indirect process is philosophical speculation, by which gradually one may come to the point of Krishna consciousness. And the other process is directly connecting everything with Krishna in Krishna consciousness. Of these two, the path of Krishna consciousness is better because it does not depend on purifying the senses by a philosophical process. Krishna consciousness is itself the purifying process, and by the direct method of devotional service, it is simultaneously easy and sublime. Om Ajnana Jivanandasya Ajnanjala Shalakaya Chakshurmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Bhuratananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Arjuna begins this third chapter with a statement of confusion. Apparently, Arjuna can't understand what Krishna is talking about and is asking for clarification. Behind the apparent confusion of Arjuna is a little trickiness. In that, Arjuna thinks he has heard something from Krishna which would lead him to the conclusion that he doesn't have to fight, because actually, not fighting would be the higher position. He thinks he may have heard Krishna imply something like that. And, as a proper disciple, Arjuna is bringing the point up for clarification. Basically, in the first verse of the third chapter, Arjuna is saying, excuse me if you don't mind me saying so, but since you mentioned in the previous chapter the word buddhi, using your intelligence, analyzing things, separating yourself from karmic actions and reactions, since you said that so often, then Tatkim Karmani Gore Mam. Why are you asking me to engage in this ghastly warfare? Seeing how apparently you have said that it's better that you analyze the whole process of material nature, separate yourself from it, use intellectual discrimination. It all sounds good to me. But then why do I have to fight? He's asking Krishna for clarification. And as Prabhupada writes in the purport, Arjuna wanted to skillfully avoid the fighting by using Krishna consciousness as an excuse. But he is presenting the matter to Krishna, and there will be clarification. Arjuna admits in the second verse that my intelligence is bewildered by your equivocal instructions. Equivocal meaning, it seems like things could be interpreted in two different ways. Therefore, he's humbly asking Krishna, you hit the nail right on the head for me. Tare kam vada. Tell me the one thing, only one thing. Just make it clear, make it dramatically, strikingly clear what I should do, what will be most beneficial for me. Now, of course, Krishna has not gone out of his way to confuse Arjuna. Krishna has indeed, in the second chapter of the Gita, presented a whole overview of the various elements of the process of perfection. But Arjuna, knowing that in the future people's intelligence will shrink extraordinarily, as it has done today, Arjuna is saying, make it especially clear. In this way, Arjuna is being very compassionate on all the future hearers of Bhagavad Gita. Tare kam vada, tell me the one thing. Because apparently you've been talking about work and work without reaction. You've been talking about analytical study, analyzing material nature. I'm a little confused. Please make it very clear. And now, in today's verse, the Supreme Personality of Godhead will speak once again. Sri Bhagavanuvacha Lokesmin Vipada Nishta Pura Prokta Mayanaga. Alright. There are two types of persons who try to understand the self. The speculators and the bhaktas, the devotional yogis. How many of us take it seriously that our real career in life is to understand the self? This kind of career goal is not considered very appropriate today. Everything has to have a financial value. The more financially lucrative your decision in terms of what to do with your life is, the more people applaud, the more support and respect you get, the more you are considered a very cultured person, refined, all based on the size of your bank account. When people hear that you have happened upon a career that has expanding financial possibilities, people pat you on the back. Well done. You lucked out somehow. Here in a city like London, the economic pressures are so great. And naturally, you can easily become caught up in all this. Don't ever think that you're going to be able to satisfy your material desires. Indeed, real booty, real intelligence means to understand that material nature will never fulfill you. It will simply offer you the dream, but the fulfillment never comes. I know this can seem a little strange to you. I know this may seem a little even cruel to you, because you can say, well, look, what's the point in our having desires if they're never going to be fulfilled? Who arranged this system? It seems almost sadistic. I've got desires. So certainly, no, they should be fulfilled at one time or another. 1 + 1 = 2. I have desires. That means there will be some fulfillment. The masses of people will all nod their heads, yes, yes. Your ship will come in one day. Your dream boat will arrive. You'll get over somehow, someday. Let's keep on struggling. Real intelligence, real booty means to understand it is not the job of material nature to fulfill desires. That sounds very cold, doesn't it? Material nature simply gives you the false hope. That's all. We are living in an atmosphere of false hope. And sometimes even practitioners of Krishna consciousness in their beginning phases, they become... it's hard for them to swallow this point. Such as what Krishna says later in Bhagavad Gita. Asha Pasha Shatayar Buddha. Bound by a network of false hopes. Just like a fish is caught in a net. We're caught in the net of false hopes. And what are those hopes for? Those false hopes are for being fulfilled. We have this body. Body means a bag of senses. Indriyani Pranyo. So the senses in this body, including the mind, the sixth sense, are always hankering for fulfillment. You catch yourself doing this and you'll be able to see where you're at. When you think body, think senses. It's not that simply your body is like a lump of flesh. No, it's a conglomeration of senses. And those senses in the mind are always looking for satisfaction and fulfillment. If you're at all going to understand the self, then you must understand that in this particular atmosphere known as material nature, your hopes will not be fulfilled. You're just given the promise, that's all. If you can understand this point, you'll save yourself so much trouble. You'll be able to separate the promise from the reality. Now, inside our hearts, there may be some bitterness, some resentment against the Supreme Intelligence who designed this system of desire and non-fulfillment in material nature. Why has Krishna done this to us? It's not fair. Our senses, our mind gush with desires, and then you tell us that those desires cannot be fulfilled in the material atmosphere. This seems cruel. If it's so natural to desire materially, and it feels natural to desire materially, doesn't it? Actually, from the awakened point of view, to desire materially is a perverted disease condition. But under the influence of material nature, we feel that having material desires is natural. I mean, everyone has them. What's the big deal? This shows you how deep we are in forgetfulness of our original constitutional position to be Krishna's servants. Material desires feel natural to us, but actually they're completely unnatural. Actually, you cannot think of anything more unnatural in existence than to have material desires. But under the sleeping, bewildering influence of Maya, we think having material desires is normal, and there's a few great souls who don't have them, but most people have them. Practically everyone has them, and just gotta learn to live with them. Learn to live with them. Accept them. That's the contemporary mood, isn't it? Accept your desires. Be at peace with them. No need to be ashamed. Accept yourself with your limitations, your mistakes. Accept the good about you and the bad about you, and that's self-realization. Acceptance. No doubt so many of you accepted that kind of notion of acceptance as the symptom of a refined and cultured person. Whatever it is, I accept. First of all, I have to accept myself, and then I accept you. I have things that are wrong about me, not too much, a few things. there's no need for me to pressure myself to correct these few wrong things about me, because it's just all part of the variegatedness of my existence to have some anarthas, you see, to have some defects. It's all just part of living. And one just has to accept that there are defects in you and just enjoy them. Enjoy the good, enjoy the bad. Don't be too hard on yourself. Don't be too hard on others. This is the kind of atmosphere we live in. An atmosphere which extinguishes any motivation you may have to attain spiritual perfection. Try to understand how oppressive the atmosphere is. First, our mind is bewildered, thinking, I have desires, therefore there'll be fulfillment. You have 1 + 1 = 2. You have desires. You have material nature. Equals fulfillment. Right? This is all I have. And now we hear, it's not possible, it's not going to happen. And so, the resentment can well up in the heart. But then we hear, inane form qualities and pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. And we begin to understand, there is a place of perfect desire. There is a place where desire is fulfilled unlimitedly. But it's not here. It's not in material activities. It is in direct Krishna conscious activities. Therefore, our soul finds its solace, its relief, its perfect expression in the 9 processes of devotional service. Anyone who commits themselves to the 9 processes of devotional service is considered the most learned, most educated person. Prahlad Maharaj says this in the 7th canto. Tam manye dita uttama. I consider that person to be the topmost smart person who is absorbed in the 9 processes of devotional service. We have to be honest. There is a good chance we have some resentment against Krishna. He has his perfect pastimes. We've come to know about them. And all we want is a little bit of material enjoyment, right? None of you here will say you want a lot of material enjoyment. Just a little bit, that's all. It's like we want to tell Krishna, look, it'd be better for you, Krishna, if you just let us have some, and you know, then we'd be peaceful in Krishna consciousness. If you would just let us do things our way, we'd calm down and then do what you want. Okay? Let us entangle ourselves a bit. And you know, we'll straighten ourselves out later, somewhere down the road. It'll happen naturally, organically. But these unilateral, very clear and lucid prescriptions given in Bhagavad Gita, and they're very beautiful to hear, of course, but it's just a bit much to take all on. You know, take all on, isn't it? A bit much? We can sympathize with Arjuna. Tat kim karmani gauramam. Krishna, you've spoken about spiritual life. I think I understood what you said. So, why do I have to fight? In other words, Arjuna is telling Krishna, I think I hear in your words a better way to be Krishna conscious. A way that doesn't involve me doing what you want, having to fight this battle. Just correct me, Krishna, but I think that's what I heard you say. So this is our tendency. Arjuna is showing us our tendency. We feel that spiritual life should be what is called a co-creative process. We and Krishna, you know, kind of work out the path, you know? You know, the bhakti marg, the bhakti path, shouldn't be so, you know, it shouldn't be all coming from Krishna, right? Some should come from Krishna. All right, 51%. But we should have a significant portion of the responsibility for deciding what the path is. This is what's going on in our hearts to some degree, and therefore we have some lumps in our heart. You have to really examine yourself and see that there are some lumps there, some resentment against Krishna. The more that you become Krishna conscious, the more you realize that everything Krishna says is overflowing with unlimited love. What we perceive as being firm and stern and uncompromising actually is just an unlimited flow of mercy and love. Bhagavad Gita is the love book. It's a love book in the wrappings of a dialogue in between two armies on a battlefield. Even the whole battlefield situation, because Krishna is there, it's about real love. Because anyone who dies on that battlefield because of Krishna's presence, those who give up their bodies seeing Krishna, they go back to Godhead. It is because of our faulty vision that we see this sternness, this too staunchness of Bhagavad Gita. And therefore we may get a little afraid. But as we become more advanced in the bhakti process, we see that every word of Bhagavad Gita is overflowing with limitless compassion and love. And as we become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, we realize the more I hear Bhagavad Gita, the more loving I become, the more I understand what is real love. You hang on to Krishna's every word in Bhagavad Gita, knowing that your heart will be flooded with divine love. Just like at the end of Bhagavad Gita. It is said that by hearing Bhagavad Gita, the hairs are standing on end. It's a thrill every moment. So where do we come up with this sternness, this like too strict father when we hear Bhagavad Gita? That's our own rebellious nature concocting that. We don't know what real love is. That's our basic problem. And it takes a lot of humility for us to accept that. You can just look yourself in the eyes and to admit, I don't know what real love is. Do you really accept that? No, everyone thinks, I know what love is, and the problem is I'm not getting it. There's something wrong with the world. Not getting the love, which I should get. There's something wrong with the devotees. They're not giving me the love that I should get. And I do know what love is. Humility means to understand we don't know what love is. And you can tell that, you can discern that we don't know what love is by this perverted reaction to Bhagavad Gita. Too stern, too strict. New Age people like to say that Bhagavad Gita is the number one dogma book. Meaning it's just full of just unilateral orders. Please try to deal with this false perception, this fear we have of Bhagavad Gita. And once you deal with that fear, you'll be able to start to feel the unlimited love in every word that Krishna speaks. You'll be able to bathe your consciousness with that love. And that way, your material desires will decrease. Otherwise, there's no hope that material desires will decrease, especially living in an atmosphere that people live in today. Do you really think that materially it's possible that you'll be satisfied and say, all right, I've had enough. I don't need any more. That's not the way the material energy works. You never get satiation. You always have to have more. It's got nothing really to do with you, in one sense. It's all to do with the atmosphere that you live in. And because you're tiny, you get swept away by that atmosphere. Anyone will. Don't have false faith in yourself. I know how much I need, and I'll draw the line in terms of material desires. I'll be able to just draw the line in the sand and say, enough is enough. I've got enough money. I've got enough conveniences. I've got enough this and that. I've had enough sense gratification. Enough's enough. It doesn't work like that. Think of the dynamic atmosphere of the material energy, which doesn't just stay still. It's always, there's always an onslaught. One example. In Silicon Valley, there was recently a study of millionaires. And to qualify to be in this study for this sociological research, you had to have a home that was worth at least $1 million. You had to have investments that were worth at least $1 million. And number three, you had to have in the bank $1 million in cold cash. And then you could you could be part of the sociological research. And so, what did every person say who was interviewed? a huge batch of these millionaires. Remember, a house worth at least $1 million, $1 million in investments, and $1 million in cold cash. What did each of them say? I just don't have enough yet. If I had another $1 million, then I would be secure. They would all say things like that. And they would defend themselves. You don't understand. $1 million today is not like $1 million 10 years ago. So therefore, if I just had another $1 million, then I would be secure. It sounds shocking to you. But this is the nature of material existence. It's not like they have some character fault as separate from material existence. You've got to see how living in the material existence brings out this craziness. And it will happen to you also if you're in contact with the wrong energy. So just don't think, oh, these guys are out of it. I mean, Californians, I mean, what do you expect? No. They are in the Prakriti Stani, the oppressive material atmosphere. And the material atmosphere is pushing them that you don't have enough. You can't be secure. You can't rest yet. And so what were most of them doing? 90% of this batch of 50 or so millionaires that were studied, they were working 70 hours a week. Because they weren't feeling secure yet. Now, I know some of you are thinking, well, those people are out of it. They're just strange. It's bizarre. I would never be like that. You know? Just give me a little sense gratification and I would acknowledge. That's enough. Okay. Fulfilled. Yeah. Now I'll go on peacefully chanting Hare Krishna. No. The material nature will never let you rest in peace. Another interesting thing that this batch of Silicon Valley millionaires said was that, because they were defending themselves. You think we're millionaires and therefore we've got it made. You don't understand. We don't have enough yet. We're not secure. Remember, once again, a house worth $1 million, $1 million in investments, and $1 million cold cash in the bank. We're not secure. Anything could happen tomorrow. And then, most of them gave the ultimate defense. It's, and besides, how do you expect us to be peaceful and to just, you know, abandon all striving when in this very neighborhood of Silicon Valley, there are people with so much more money than we have. How do you expect us to remain, to stand still when you know across the street there's someone with 50 million? They all said that. Once again, I know you're thinking, oh, I would never be like that. If I had what they had, you know, I would just call it quits right there. Okay, $1 million in the bank, $1 million in investments, $1 million home, enough. Simple living. Do you understand there's something about the material energy that will not let you just be in peace? You've got to always strive. Because you're living in the Rajagun atmosphere, passion. Therefore, these men and ladies were working 70 and even 80 hours a week. This is how deadly material existence is. Yet, we like to feel comfortable and at home in material existence, and we're afraid of Krishna. This is our problem. Here the Lord is pointing out there are two types of persons who try to realize the self. How many people today are interested in realizing the self? Look at you like, hey, are you from the 60s or something? Trying to realize the self. This is the unfortunate climate that we live in. A further point we should meditate on is Krishna calls Arjuna Anaga, O sinless one. The fact is, until we are free from sinful activity, we'll never understand the self. So the few people today who are indeed motivated in self-realization are motivated to try and understand who they are. They're getting nowhere because of sinful activity. As we always explain, knowledge, real knowledge, is state-specific. In order to understand real knowledge, you have to change your consciousness. According to how your consciousness changes, that's how much real knowledge you can understand. This principle is alien to the Western conception of knowledge and understanding. In the Western conception, what does your behavior have to do with what you know? How many of you, when you went to school, whether it's secondary or tertiary or whatever, were asked questions about your character and your personal behavior? What's that got to do with it? Where are your grades? Where are your references? It is not accepted in Western culture that your personal behavior influences what you can understand. Therefore, Krishna here, and in countless places in Bhagavad Gita, is pointing out that what you know depends on how you behave. Therefore, Anaga, Arjuna, you are sinless. I'm talking to someone who's sinless, and therefore that person can understand higher knowledge. I think that sometimes some of you become a little shocked when you see someone who was practicing Krishna consciousness a few months ago, and then they lost the plot, became implicated in Kali Yuga once again, and their whole outlook changes. Their whole thought process changes. The way of looking at things changes. And you're kind of shocked, like, wait a minute. What happened? Just 2 months ago, you were seeing things quite clearly. And now, your brain, your thinking, your consciousness has become so murky. What's going on? What's going on is that you change the way you act, and that means you change what you can understand. What I'm talking about now is something that is not accepted by the material culture we live in. But it is a guiding principle in Bhagavad Gita. Your personal behavior influences what you are able to understand. So it's not that we can act in any way we like and we'll be able to understand Krishna consciousness as good as the next person. No. This is why we have given to us a whole system of purified activities. By engaging in those purified activities, our capacity to be sane increases. And the more we neglect these purifying activities, the more we're stuck in the insanity of Kali Yuga, no matter how polished that insanity will be. And what is the first symptom you can always see of insanity in Kali Yuga? I have material desires. Therefore, they'll be fulfilled. This is insanity. But it's an insanity that the whole world embraces and rejoices in. Therefore, sometimes you can feel alone and isolated in your quest to be Krishna conscious. And that is why, more than ever, we need the association of devotees. Being around a devotee means you're feeling constant inspiration in understanding that purified activities will lead to a deeper understanding of Krishna. I'll actually be able to understand myself. When you talk about yourself, you must talk about Krishna, because Krishna is the self of the self. Now, briefly speaking, Arjuna was apparently confused because Krishna was turning the diamond of spiritual perfection this way and that way, highlighting different aspects in the previous chapter. But Arjuna thought that that meant Krishna's way of presenting things in that way meant that there was some disunity between Sankhya analysis of what is matter, what is spirit, and acting with bhakti, when actually these both are aspects of bhakti. Understanding the spiritual energy, understanding what you are not, what you are, and engaging in activities to please Krishna's senses. This is all part of the whole package. But Krishna had first been speaking about one aspect, one facet, then another aspect, another facet of the same jewel. But Arjuna saw it all as disparate. He saw it all as like a conglomeration of different things. But now Krishna is going to tell him that all these different elements of self-realization work together perfectly in bhakti. And for us, we see that most clearly in Lord Chaitanya, as Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya has certified. Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. Shikshakam Eka Purusha Purana. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Sharidhari Kripambudya Yastamaham Prabhaje. Let me offer my obeisances to Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the ocean of mercy, Kripambudi, who, although he's Krishna himself, he appeared in this age of Kali to teach Vairagya and Vidya, detachment and knowledge. Detachment from everything that gets in the way of Krishna consciousness, and knowledge of everything that brings about attachment for Krishna. Lord Chaitanya's chanting and dancing accomplishes all the purposes of Sankhya Yoga. The more you chant and dance, the better you can understand the material energy. What is illusion? The more you chant and dance, the more you can see what is real desire, what is illusory desire. This is Lord Chaitanya, who in the darkest age, he's bringing about the greatest light and making it possible for everyone to follow Krishna's instructions. This is Lord Chaitanya. So, what Krishna here is once again explaining to Arjuna in a different way, so that Arjuna can catch the point. The unity of all the different aspects of bhakti. Lord Chaitanya demonstrates it so easily in action. And we are all part of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, where easily the different aspects of bhakti are fused together, and we can take advantage of them. This is Lord Chaitanya's mercy. By the chanting and dancing, we have philosophical discrimination. What is matter? What is spirit? By the chanting and dancing, we see the self as the servant of Krishna. Krishna has made everything so easy for us in Kali Yuga. So please, let us not feel unconscious resentment that our material desires will not be fulfilled. Let us be very happy